Just a quick note before we get the show started. About midway through, Larry's internet connection basically became unusable, so we had to switch over to using a phone. I apologize for the sound quality. We did the best we could with what we had, and so we kind of cut the show short, but still, we got through most of it. Again, apologize for the sound quality. Enjoy. Hey, Larry.
Hey, Andy.
How are you?
Was that a fast enough comeback?
That was on it, man. There was no lag there at all.
Let's do it.
All right. Somebody wrote in something, and I just kind of want to go off on a little bit of a tangent just for a minute and talk about conspiracy theories for a second before we start running things down. And the closest thing that I have seen to a conspiracy theory come true is I heard about this Cambridge Analytical thing where, like, and not to go into the politics side of it, but this company was getting data from Facebook and they were then targeting ads to people to very, very highly, highly, highly targeted ads. I heard about it between 12 and 18 months ago. And it seemed very like this piece leads to this piece, this leads to this. And it just kept going on down this whole chain of events. But eventually something comes out that kind of breaks the thing open. And people frequently, frequently, frequently talk about some gigantic conspiracy theory, some bullshit pale white horse thing. And it just freaks me out that if you're going to send us a message about something and you put in conspiracy theory, you better back it up with something, or I there's just nothing we can do with it. We can't go reference it. We can't go look it up. We can't talk about it. And here you are telling us conspiracy theory to get all the people locked up for all of the charges. And it makes no sense to me.
Well, do any of the conspiracy theories make sense when you dissect them?
But that's my point, is if the person reading about the conspiracy theory would try and follow the chain of events down through things of reputable sources, if you're following Alex Jones, we have issues right there with your sources. They're demonstrably false, or they're severely lacking in evidence. Not that no evidence doesn't mean it's not true, but it makes it harder to prove something if you don't have evidence to go against. Am I wrong?
So, no, you're not wrong. The Apollo program was a conspiracy.
Oh, right, that's right. They never landed on the moon. Sorry, I forgot about that one.
Yes, that was a conspiracy. You can tell by looking at those shadows in the photos that those were all doctored.
And the dust and the camera being there, had was there a camera there to take pictures of the astronauts as they took their first steps? There's a truckload of evidence to talk about how those things have come about. But 9/11, Obama not being from the United States, all that stuff is just garbage to divert your attention from the real issue.
So, but we're always going to have conspiracy theories because there are people out there that I guess they have some benefit derived from creating them.
It seems like it would be more productive if you're going to say that the sex offender issue that we're talking about is a conspiracy. That if you learn how the process works, how the legislative process works, how it goes through the various houses and the various stages, you could figure out how it works. And then maybe the veil is removed and you go, oh, that's how it works. And it's not a conspiracy. The reason why there are these laws against us is because the people we voted for put the policies in place. That's how it happened.
Yeah, that's how we just got a huge budget deal that no one read
2,000
passed at the
pages.
federal level. No one read. Of course, now on the Affordable Care Act, people were criticized for not reading that. Remember, although it took many months to get that through, not just a few days that this went through, that's how we got this budget through. It was a giant conspiracy, but it wasn't a conspiracy at all. It was the need to fund the remaining unappropriated. I think there's 13 general appropriation bills, if I'm not mistaken. It was to fill out the remaining of the departments that had not been funded. And the minority party used the leverage it could to extract concessions, because when you're in the minority, you don't have the ability to pass anything. You have the ability to use leverage. So they used leverage to get more programs funded that they wanted in exchange for the giant, humongous increase in military spending that the administration wanted, and the administration could not get support from the majority party, or at least from the more conservative members of the majority caucus, the Freedom Caucus. They couldn't get support, so they had to reach across the aisle and get support from the Democratic Party, which they had to grant concessions. That's how the process works. Well, on the registries, the registries were passed because they were asked for by law enforcement, and we weren't there to express any opposition or explain what would be wrong with registries. So there was no real debate on most of these registry laws. They just went right through with a rubber stamp.
Because they ran unopposed. And if somebody from our side, you, Brenda, whomever, possibly could have slowed it down, made it less bad, not likely stop it, but make it less bad. And you might have to throw somebody else under the bus. If you can save 10 to throw one under the bus, maybe that's the right deal, right? Maybe?
Well, it's I call that pragmatism. If I can get a better advantage and give up something, I have to analyze how valuable what we're giving up is in the totality and weigh that against what you're gaining. And as we move to try to reform the registry, there will be compromises that will have to be made, and the registry won't end overnight. So there will be a process of peeling the onion, and it'll frustrate people because we'll be accused of selling out and not ending it for everybody, and that's just not politically doable.
Right, and finding an issue that impacts the most people, such as a homeless issue, residency restrictions make people homeless often. That seems like it would be a good issue to go over. I don't know, against something that is more nuanced, affects less people, but maybe is more popular, and I'm not going to name names. But anyway, you ready to roll?
I'm ready to roll, Andy. Let's have, do we have some exciting news tonight?
Yes, there's a bunch of stuff. There's some good articles in there. But if you're listening to us via the website, we're delighted to have you. But it would be easier for you and better for us if you made us part of your feed on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, TuneIn. I started uploading to YouTube. I started going to SoundCloud, etc. If you like what you hear, please write a review. And if you don't, forget everything I just said. Fuck you, people. You can support us at patreon.com/registrymatters. Even a dollar contribution would be appreciated greatly. So the first article is from The Intercept. Philadelphia DA Larry Krasner promised a criminal justice revolution. He's exceeding expectations. So this guy, I think he won by a pretty strong majority. This would have happened in November. He's a civil rights attorney. And he's doing some really, really interesting things as far as how he is directing his prosecutors to go after cases. And I think this one is significantly poignant because we talked, I don't know if it was the actual subject, but we at least glanced over about DAs. If we wanted to reduce prison populations, DAs could say bring fewer cases. So he's directed his prosecutors to say, if you're seeking something less than 2 years, just do something like house arrest. Or if prisons cost, you know, pick a number, $30,000, $40,000 a year, put the total, if you're going to put somebody in prison for 3 years, put that it's going to cost $90,000 or $120,000 on the sentencing sheet so that the prosecutor is somehow conscious of how much money they're costing taxpayers. So I have some questions, and I wanted you to explain crimes of about paraphernalia.
That is a little easier to explain.
Okay.
There's a number of things that police arrest people for possessing, and frequently drug paraphernalia that would be coming to my mind.
So needles, as an example. I'm not a drug user, never have been, so this is kind of a new thing for me.
Well, I think that and the clips that you would make a joint, what do you call that?
Roach clips.
And then there's a pipe that you could smoke it in that would have residue, and that would be drug paraphernalia. So that it's bizarre because all those items are legal, but apparently if you possess them, you're automatically using them to commit a crime. I didn't quite understand that in my experience, but that's what happens. A lot of people a lot of people get arrested for possession of drug paraphernalia.
What else did you think about this particular individual taking the seat there in Philadelphia?
Well, he's really got my attention when I found this article, because a lot of campaigns are centered around reform. My local district attorney here in Bernalillo County ran as a reformer, and we've seen scant evidence of it. His 2016 campaign, if you were to look at what he's been doing, which is asking for a significant, I mean, millions of dollars of more of funding for prosecutions to clear out the backlog of old cases. So this guy actually ran on a reform campaign, a similar type of reform campaign, but he actually meant it in Philadelphia, this Larry Krasner. And when you come in with that type of attitude, taking over to change the way the office operates, he apparently had to fire 31 prosecutors right from the get-go, because they were not committed to his idea of how the office was going to be managed.
There was also something in there about officers that were listed as a do not call.
Yeah, I think those were that they had demonstrated through their previous testimony that they were not reliable and were tainted police officers, and so there was a court order issued, and Krasner was actually obeying it, unlike Sheriff Arpaio, that chose to thumb his nose at the court. But this is really good stuff to see that a person really wants to analyze the financial. But see, folks, he ran for office. You got to ask yourself, if you were in middle Georgia or north Georgia, outside of Atlanta Metro, could you have won this on this platform? Yeah, if you were running this type of office for this district attorney's office, prosecutor, or state's attorney position in Tallahassee, Florida, could you win promising that you were going to prosecute fewer people and look for alternatives? Because apparently the citizens of Philadelphia or believe in reform, but I'm not sure this platform would be a successful, make for a successful candidacy in many other parts of the country.
No, because our other politicians say, lock them up, lock them up, lock them up.
Well, and that's what the people want to hear. But apparently the citizens of Philadelphia didn't want to hear that.
So there's a paragraph in the article. It says, under the heading, divert more, Krasner then instructed prosecutors to avoid convictions, if possible, and guide cases for diversion programs instead of jail or prison. That is unto itself an amazing statement.
Well, it's not that amazing. That was a directive from former Attorney General Holder under the Obama administration, was to try to do the same similar thing. But what you saw as a result of that policy was you saw the law and order candidacy in 2016 was that that there's been a tidal wave of crime turned loose on America, and I'm going to be the one that cleans it up. And who did the citizens vote for?
60 million.
Sixty million voted for the law and order candidate.
Yes.
So every time we take this to the people don't say what we want to hear in terms of the reform. They want them locked up. The citizens in 2016 nationally told us that they wanted the lock them up candidate, and that's who that got elected.
Yep. And the city centers, the metropolis kind of places, they voted blue, where the rest of the country more or less went red.
That would be the case, and this Philadelphia is a major urban center, so yep. You would have a more likely to have a more progressive lean on the voters there than you would have if you were in western Nebraska or western Michigan. If you were in Kent or Ottawa County, pick on Michigan for a while. I've lived there before.
Okay, yeah, go there. That's fine. But I'm glad you brought the article to our attention, because I think it's at a minimum, it's a model for us to look at when someone makes a claim about something. This would be a benchmark for us to see how somebody else would act with similar claims.
I hope he succeeds, but he's really, he's up against a powerful force structure. The law enforcement apparatus, which when I say the apparatus, I'm talking about the police, the sheriffs, the state police, the he's not going to be able to fire every prosecutor. He's not going to be able to fire the judicial officials, the probation officers. So you've got a whole apparatus that doesn't necessarily think this way. And he can control a certain part of that apparatus, but there will be a lot of pushback against him. The law enforcement apparatus will try to convince the public that he's endangering them. And depending on which way the media covers it, it'd be interesting to see who succeeds, which side succeeds.
And then if probation and parole violate people, do they go before the DA for that whole process?
Or generally speaking, probation violations go before a judicial setting, and parole violations generally go through the administrative process, because that's an extension of prison. So you would not necessarily have the DA involved in parole violations. But okay. In probation violations, generally, yes.
Okay. So he does have the ability to impact that side of things too. If someone, you know, if they get caught having a beer, actually the next article we're covering seems like it might be a decent candidate for this. But if you get caught with a beer and your probation officer then violates you and it ends up in front of the DA, he could be like, "You guys are morons. He just had a beer. Let it go."
Absolutely. The DA could decline, but then again, you're dealing with that bureaucracy. Say, for example, if the bureaucracy, like in my state, would be probation parole is under state control. So the executive branch runs the state probation parole. So say we have a very conservative executive branch at the state level. They don't like what he's doing when they take those cases to the DA, and the DA says, I'm not doing anything. This is a minor violation. Well, the executive branch has enormous powers. They have relationships with the media. They run the day-to-day affairs of government. And all of their employees that work for the probation parole division, you can put a lot of pressure on the district attorney and start putting out false information. You can start vilifying it. He's sticking himself out there, and he probably just doesn't care. He's going to do his job the way he sees fit, as long as he has it. But he's not going to have magic buy-in from everybody. There are people that will be in various parts of government that will not agree with what he's doing.
Well, spit it out for me just a little bit further. So they start putting out ad campaigns, just trashing the guy, but then the election comes around again and the people vote for him again. I mean, he's still the guy in office doing those things. And yeah, the other branch of the government is trashing him, but the people are still weighing in. I guess then, do you think they then change who they're voting for governor and so forth?
Oh, well, that's a bigger constituency than the city of Philadelphia. But
sure. Oh, true. Sure.
Yeah, you got a Pennsylvania has moved in a very conservative direction,
right,
as a state. Although they did move away from the governor that only served one term. I'm forgetting his name, Tom Corbett. They just he didn't get reelected. But you can do disinformation. You can smear people. You can start rumors. And a lot of what we hear in the media is simply because a person's not liked. They've irritated someone. So there's all sorts of things that can be done to make this man look bad. And the average voter is not going to be able to dig deep enough to figure this out.
Right. Yeah, they're just watching their evening news, if they're even watching that, and they see something go by saying, this DA is making Philadelphians much more unsafe by letting these hardened criminals go free.
Far more sinister than that he was observed doing an undercover drug buy or something.
Right, I mean, right.
You could try to do character assassination on the guy and generate an investigation, and then he's distracted by the investigation of himself. So powerful forces don't like change, and,
right.
and we've got a person who wants to do dramatic change, and that's hard for the change is hard for people because it upsets the routine.
The Titanic couldn't move out of the way of that iceberg fast enough.
Well, people's livelihoods depend on the status quo, whatever that status quo is, whether it's big oil,
yeah,
whether it's big pharma, mm-hmm. whether it's big business with prisons. The criminal justice system, and coming in and saying that we're doing all these things wrong, and we're gonna, not lock up. We I think we have 4% of the world's population, and we have, what, 25, 30% of the incarcerated individuals.
You are very close on those numbers, that I understand them. Yes.
So we and, you know, Americans don't really like to ever consider that they've done, that they're doing anything wrong. They, the average American likes to believe that we do no wrong and we make no mistakes. So you've got that mentality. When you start trying to make change, that's when we got our comment a few episodes back that we should love it or leave it. So change is hard. And you're talking about if you were to move away from this massive incarceration system we have dramatically, where would these people go for jobs and employment? They're trained to work in prisons.
Right.
It'd be like when you close the industrial plants. These people, that's all they've done for 20 years, and they don't have the skills to go out in the modern information economy. And it's a painful process, because this is what they thought their entire life was going to be. I was going to work here in this factory, and I was going to get my defined benefit from the company, and all that's upset when they offshore the production. So change is hard.
There was a company that I worked at, and they announced that they were closing down. And I heard a lady walking in the parking lot. She's like, "I'm 55 years old. This is all I've ever done. What am I going to do now? No one's going to hire me."
Well, and that's there's some legitimacy in that. Without the training, see, America, the training that we need to do to upgrade our workforce, we're not very good at that. Yes, there are places where there's educational opportunities, but education is very expensive, and getting the training for the skills that the modern economy needs is very difficult. I'm not saying that these things can't happen, but it's a painful adjustment when you're going from that type of work to relearning, retraining all over, and a 50-plus-year-old has, well, I've got to go $40,000 in debt to get trained to do something I'm only going to be able to do for 10, 12 years.
Yeah, that's a hard equation to try and follow.
So it's easier to be mad at the system and say that we just need to keep the status quo. And the last presidential election catered to a lot of that. They were able to tap into a lot of that people's pain because of the dramatic change in the economy. And the middle class, as they knew it, had passed them by because of offshore. Primarily, offshoring has done a lot of companies moving their production offshore.
It's hard to argue with paying somebody a dollar an hour versus 25. It's really hard to argue with that.
So, well, that's what I told a good friend of mine recently. We were in a debate, and I said, well, America can be really competitive. All we have to do is scrap all of our environmental regulations. We don't need to worry about water, air. We don't need to worry about job place safety, and we don't need to worry about employment benefits, and we don't need to be worried about attractive wages. And if we do all that, we will be very competitive.
Absolutely.
With the rest of the world.
Big screen, flat TVs. Absolutely.
That's all we have to do.
2.3 cars per person, whatever that number is, or 1.5 cars per person.
But the average American doesn't want to give up all those things to be competitive. The average American is not going to want to work for a dollar an hour, not going to want to have a lack of any benefits whatsoever to their job. They're not going to want to totally scrap the environmental regulations and safety regulations. So those are not feasible adjustments. So we have to do it with productivity. If we're going to have an advantage, we have to do it with enhanced productivity. And that means mechanization, because they don't require benefits. They don't require time off. They don't require maternity leave. The machines just keep working.
But they do require people to support them.
Yes. But the people that support them have to have skills generally a little bit higher than what the people were that were feeding that garment.
Absolutely.
Through the device that was doing whatever garment factories do.
Mm-hmm.
But when we used to be a major textile center in this country, we're not so much anymore. Our shoes, I think, have all but vanished from American production. Hmm. There might be a little bit of a New England shoe business left, but we've largely given up on textiles. We've given up on shoe manufacturing. We've given up on small appliances. We've given up on electronics. We still do make some heavy industrial equipment here. We're good on airplanes and. But a lot of manufacturing here that we used to do is no longer around.
We are still a massive manufacturing powerhouse.
Absolutely.
Though.
Absolutely. People get, there's a lot of stuff made in America. When they say nothing's made here, there's an awful lot of stuff made here. But a lot of stuff that used to be made here is not.
It just so happens it's of a much higher value instead of it being commodity. I don't know if I'm using the right words there, but that's, like you said, it, you know, making shirts, not custom tailored French Armani suits, whatever, but just your run of the mill Walmart t-shirt type things.
You'd be hard pressed to find any garment like that made in America, as far as I know.
Yep, agreed. Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact us at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. To support Registry Matters on a monthly basis, head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at iTunes or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about us. We want to send out our big, heartfelt support for those on the registry. And don't forget to say, fuck you people. You fucking matter. You make it possible. We got some good news from West Virginia.
We sure did.
Supreme Court says restricting internet access while on parole violates First Amendment. You've shared similar ideas with me about this in the past, that they, the establishment, can't make complete bans on your internet usage. And it, I think the caveat there would be, if you've got an internet-related crime, I think then there's probably some precedent for it being there. But if you, Romeo and Juliet, and then it's 20 years later, they can't take it away from you or restrict you from it up front. So the guy that took it all the way up to the West Virginia Supreme Court, he did 27 years in prison starting in 87. And then he gets out and he's living with a girlfriend. And she has a computer and a cell phone, and we don't necessarily know, but they probably had internet access, but he supposedly never touched them. Parole officer comes in and checks and goes, come on, let's go. And he does 3 years in prison or in jail. He gets violated for that situation. That in itself seems ridiculous to me.
Well, it is ridiculous, and we have discussed this. The U.S. Supreme Court in the Packingham decision affirmed what several circuit courts had said around the country, which those cases were not binding beyond the boundaries of those circuits. But where you have a total blanket ban that a person just cannot be on the internet, that is very problematic because modern life requires you to have access. It's almost impossible to apply for a job anymore without having internet access. I mean, when's the last time you've been able to go in and pick up a paper application?
There's a Burger King nearby. It says go to like bkjobs.com to apply.
So what the court said in this case was that West Virginia's probation parole authorities were doing a restriction greater than what the U.S. Supreme Court struck down in Packingham, because the Packingham was a social media ban, and this is a total ban. So the court in West Virginia, I have to give them credit, that's their highest court. They were able to say, well, gee, we're not very bright around here, but we can see that if the U.S. Supreme Court says that a lesser ban is a problem, it only stands to reason that a greater ban is a bigger problem. So they said you can't have a blanket ban. Now, I didn't read the case thoroughly. I just glanced, so I don't know all the nuances of what they – because they usually use a lot of dicta, which gives you some guidance on what would be permissible. So I don't know what contours they established where the internet restrictions would be permissible. But I suspect it's probably around the offense itself. They would be able to contour more significant restrictions. But I don't think, in regards to the offense, they would be able to contour a total ban, because you need it. They could contour some very significant strict monitoring. But to say you just can't be on the internet, it's not feasible for the modern world. For the average person, I don't know how you would survive.
Well, specifically in this one, he wasn't even necessarily using it. They didn't do any forensics, so we can't say whether he did or didn't. However, well,
they said he had access.
Right, but he didn't. So he was near the internet, and they locked him up.
Yes, it was a tragedy for the amount of time he served, but he was the sacrificial lamb for the greater cause.
Fair.
Now the authorities in West Virginia, not Virginia, the authorities in West Virginia know that they have to peel this back, that they can't go that far. Now they, depending on their leadership, they will probably want to peel back no more than they have to. And there may have to be a subsequent challenge for the Supreme Court of West Virginia to say, damn it, we really meant this. You people can't do this. But I wouldn't be surprised if they do as little as possible to comply. That's just typically the way it goes.
Because if you're on the internet, we have another article that's going to cover this subject. If you're on the internet and you're a sex offender, then you're going to go track down all of the kids like a dragnet on a boat. And you're just going to get all of the kids.
Yeah, the only problem is it never happens. That's the only problem with that.
Well, but to move this over to the policy side, like a process strategy side, they could have. So they lock the guy up. He appeals it, and it goes to their circuit court. I think, yeah, that says circuit court in the article. And they said, you guys are morons. He gets out. The state appealed it. This is where they fucked up. They should have just left that alone and let it sit, but they appealed it and then they lost at the Supreme Court.
Well, that happens. See, you're dealing with a mindset with governments. They have virtually unlimited budgets,
right?
And these things are usually handled by the state attorney general. So there's a wiring that they can't overcome, and that's to fight. It was the kind of thing with gay marriage. I think we talked about that with same-sex marriage a few episodes back. The conservatives could not let go of the Defense of Marriage Act. So right. they insisted on getting a Supreme Court decision, and they got it.
They did.
It wasn't what they wanted. But a really intelligent analysis of this would have been they would have sat down and said, hey, let's see, we got a guy that's got a 30-plus-year-old offense, and it was against an adult, and he doesn't even know how to use the internet. We don't have any real proof. We probably don't have a really good case to appeal. So although we hate to lose, we probably will let this one go, tell the SOB that he's won, and then there's no precedential value to this, this decision. But they can't help themselves. They really can't. And it's the bulldoze ahead. We're going to win. And they win, so they lose so few. They win so many that the reason why they think that way is because it works.
Right,
they normally win. so it's shocking to them, being that I'm in the criminal defense. When we get a guilty verdict on someone who has the audacity to go to trial that they think they even have a chance, it's a celebratory moment. I mean, we put out on the listserv that such and such an attorney got a not guilty in a particular district of the state, what the charges were. It makes no difference if they could be guilty of sin. We celebrate because we seldom win, but these people seldom lose.
Right.
So they can't wire themselves to think that we need to analyze this case and maybe this is one that shouldn't go up. But now they've learned. But they will not be able to wire themselves to actually fully comply immediately. So they're not going to take a robust effort to rewrite their policies and get it out to all their field offices and get people so they can access the internet. They're going to wait for challenges and challenges. And I would bet all over the state of West Virginia, there'll be people that will be having to go into their courts and they'll have to cite this case. And Justice Ketchum's a majority opinion. They're going to have to do that to finally get these people to do what they ought to do because it's the right thing to do. They're just not, they're not likely to do that. And the listeners out there, they'll say, well, there he goes again. He's so negative. I'm just telling you how they are. I don't make the rules how they operate, but this is how they're likely to react.
But you can look at history and prove this one. You don't have to be tainted and slanted to, or cynical even to think this way. You can just look, what is it? 95% of cases don't make it to trial. They take a plea deal. It's a similar thing.
Yeah, well, and any victory that's won by our side usually gets appealed. But you got to understand, Andy, you have to give people hope. So you tell them what they want to hear. So I'm telling them that the state of West Virginia will probably fight and people will still probably get violated. That's not a message people out there listening want to hear. They want to hear that Virginia has immediately forthwith sent out an email to all their division, all their field offices, and they've scheduled a massive retraining to get their officers to know that they can't do this anymore and that they've got people in line. That's not likely the way, but that's what people would prefer to hear.
Oh, negative Larry.
And I can't help myself because I can't wire myself to tell people what they want here.
I don't want to do that either. If you are listening to us expecting that message, go find another show. I'm not trying. I don't want to sugarcoat it, but I also don't want to make it worse than it is. All right. This is for you to set up about the Minnesota from the Washington Post, the Minnesota loophole and groping.
So, well, I found the article, and the Minnesota Assembly is going to change the statute, but apparently to touch an adult over the clothing is not prosecutable under current law. So they're going to pass the law that if you touch someone's buttocks, it would be prosecutable. I haven't read the proposed language of the statute, but of what they're proposing, but it's going to be difficult to stop something like that.
Well, sure. And so in the article, it says, on Thursday, a state Senate committee approved a measure to get rid of the exemption and make groping of the buttocks a misdemeanor punishable by up to a year in prison and a $3,000 fine. I mean, like, first of all, you're a dick for just running around and touching people's butts. There's a example of somebody at a gym, and he reportedly did it four times in a single day of some chick doing squats or lunges or whatever, and he goes up and cups their rumps. I mean, you're an asshole, but why wouldn't that be some form of assault? It doesn't have to be sexual assault or sexual misconduct. You have put your hands on someone else. Shouldn't that alone be illegal?
Well, it probably is probably a battery. I think that would but see, that you got to understand, people want a more serious charge. It's not enough that we have a way to prosecute something. It's that it has to be a heinous prosecution so that they get the picture of how ridiculous. So it would be interesting to know if this is going to be a registrable sex offense, because if a battery would probably be what you could prosecute now, I would bet, but that's not going to have a sexual offense registration required to it. So I don't know the answer to whether this is going to require registration or not.
Right.
But I'm guessing it will.
Well, it says, in fact, the state's main sexual conduct statute specifically exempts intentional touching of the clothing covering the immediate area. This is just so funny. Covering the immediate area of the buttocks from criminal sexual misconduct. And later in the article, it says that they possibly did it because they can't find anybody that says, well, why'd y'all do this? But possibly so that a coach swats one of his players on the butt and says, hey, good game, or, you know, go get him, Tiger, whatever. And so they exempted it for that reason. And I just find that it's like, so when the school year starts, there has to be some sort of permission slip that you send home to your parents that says, hey, Coach Taylor might want to touch your child's butt. Are you okay with this? And you have to sign a waiver.
Well, I was thinking this was related only to adults, so I didn't think this applied to children, as I read the article, but now it won't let me open it again because I've already had my 5 views this month.
I can help you with that. Do you want me to get you the article?
Not really. I think this is a section of law that applies to adults. I don't think this is applicable to children.
The reason why I say that is because they said they specifically said something where. About like they made the carve out so that, you know, if a teacher, you know, coach, whatever, you know, swats the kid on the butt and says good game or get out there, toughen up, whatever. Some in law enforcement had taken to calling it the coach's exemption. One explanation they said was that lawmakers at the time wanted to create leeway for football coaches who were worried they would be accused of crimes for giving players a motivational smack on the rear.
So we'll definitely have to close that loophole.
Because you don't want to motivate the kids. But, you know, in the hindsight of the Larry Nassar stuff, yeah, we just have become hypersensitive. Any touch is bad touch. There's no context given. And so, I mean, I don't know. I just, hey, could you just say this isn't acceptable? Don't do that. And the coach then says, hey, yeah, sorry. I was just trying to motivate you to send it out there. I didn't mean anything by it. But everybody's all hypersensitive about all the things.
Yes, indeed. That is the case. We're going to see, I hope I'm wrong, but I think we're going to see a whole lot more people caught up in this system of hypersensitivity and retroactive application, not retroactive so much as, decades old allegations that are going to surface that are impossible to defend once. I mean, I don't know where this is going to end, but I don't see an end anytime real soon.
Sure. Moving on to the Marshall Project, caring for my sick husband from prison. This lady was sentenced for some financial fraud kind of stuff, and she got 12 years. And she's up in her 60s, when she was in her 60s, and she has been down for, I think, 7 years, the way the article said. And her husband has some disease called Emery-Dreifuss muscular dystrophy. And he's at home alone. They don't really have a lot of friends or family that can step in and take care of him. Not that it's necessarily their obligation to. And so she just gets to sit there in prison and watch her husband decline, and he's falling. He's not really able to feed himself very well. And she has requested to get some sort of hardship release, an empathy release from prison to go home and take care of her husband. And they've denied her twice, saying that that would be, it would minimize the severity of Miss Ferris's offense.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. We got a situation where both of them are up in years, their 70s, right?
Yeah, 73 and 4.
Yeah, 70. So neither of them pose any threat to society, any significant threat. So we're going to continue to house her in prison so that he will need health care, which will put home, convalescent type care. It'll end up being paid for by the taxpayers because they won't let her out to help provide that care as long as she's able to. And this is an economic crime. And although economic crimes should be punished, is 12 years a bit on the stiff side for an economic crime?
And then, you know, you could look at this as that there's being double dipping, that since he is going to receive some level of care at the government expense, meanwhile, she's in prison at the government expense. You could sort of, I'm sure you could craft some sort of way to put her out on parole or probation. I guess the feds don't do probation, right? Or they don't do parole.
They don't do parole.
They could let her out and tailor her probation guidelines to where that's kind of part of her sentencing, so to speak, where she would be obligated to take care of him.
Well, they apparently have a compassionate release program, but I've never in my experience can I recall a person being granted it under any administration we've had in power, at least in the last 10, 15 years that I've been actively involved in and working in law. So apparently there is a process for which it can happen, I don't know of anybody that's been granted it. Actually, there's a link here to read more about compassionate release. But there again, I believe that's an executive function. And if the executive branch doesn't want to grant that, it's a discretionary call.
Yeah.
You're not entitled to it. Well, the link doesn't take me anywhere. So you might want to click and see if it takes you anywhere.
It definitely does. The title of the article is Old, Sick, and Dying in Shackles. That's the name.
No, but the one it says to find out more about compassionate release at the bottom of the article.
Yes. Yes.
And
the subtitle of the article is Compassionate Release Has Bipartisan Support as a Way to Reduce the Federal Prison Population and Save Taxpayer Money. New data shows that it's rarely used. That's the subtitle. of the article. Well, I think where you're wanting to go with this is about the vindictive nature of how our criminal justice system is designed.
So, yeah, well, I'm reading in the article, almost 400 applications the Bureau received between 2013 and 17 are still awaiting a decision. But apparently the Bureau has to approve it, and then it's based on a judge who makes the ultimate decision, passed on to a judge. It's something that was created that was in theory possible, but apparently no one gets it. No one's granted this early release for compassionate reasons.
Well, that's does just really a tragedy.
Does it reflect who we are as a citizenry?
Well, my answer to that is, since those are the people that we vote for to put these policies in place, then yes, it reflects who we are as a society.
So
it might not be what we want as a society, but that's what we have as a society.
So what it says, compassionate release dates back to an overhaul of federal sentencing laws in the 1980s, which was done when we had the first conservative swing through when they took over the executive branch and the Senate in the 1980 election, and they abolished parole, and they did away with good time. Effectively, there's 15% possible now in the federal system. But it says Congress supplied a safety valve, giving judges the power to retroactively cut sentences short in extraordinary compelling circumstances. But a court could do so only if the Bureau of Prisons filed a motion on the inmate's behalf. So the Bureau has to apparently request it, which they're not doing, and then a judge has to grant it. And it says, for years, the agency approved only prisoners who were near death or completely debilitated, while non-medical releases were permitted. An Inspector General report found in 2013 not a single one was approved over a six-year period.
So something's been in place for almost 40 years, and it's rarely ever used.
That would be the case.
That's awesome. To help people that are in this case where Ms. Ferris is 73 years old for a crime, a white-collar crime, so you could then argue not really a victim crime, and her husband is suffering at home, and they won't let her out. What would appear to be kind of like the model reason for that policy to be in place, that she could get some sort of release to take care of her aging and failing health husband.
So, yeah, the article is pretty extensive. It says that former Attorney General Eric Holder promoted the changes to include inmates over 65. Who are the sole possible caregiver or family member as part of his Smart on Crime initiatives. But the Bureau, which is part of the Justice Department, has yet to fully embrace those changes. Of the inmates who applied for non-medical reasons, 2%, 50 cases have been approved since 2013. So yeah, your odds are not good.
Right. And then I skipped one. What did you want to do with the article about Guantanamo?
It was mainly to pontificate about indefinite detention and how we've become desensitized. America was the beacon of the world where due process was a given. So we've got people that have been, the number has shrunk under the former president to be a very low number, 40, I think it says 41. But at one time we had hundreds detained, and they were never formally charged with anything, and not a war crime, not an espionage. They were held as detainees with no due process afforded to them. And when we're willing to sit back and be desensitized to a person not being brought in a tribunal and being able to know what they're accused of and have some evidence put forward, that speaks a little something about what can happen next to the erosion of liberty, because the population as a whole has not cared much about Guantanamo. It's off the radar. There's been a few lawyers who banded together and tried to get these people into the justice system, into the court system, but we should not be detaining people without formal charges, without any due process. That goes against everything that we stand for, but yet we've been doing this for 15 years now. So that was what the article was in there for, is to say, hey guys, if you if you're willing to write off a due process, don't be surprised if yours goes next.
Well, I'm now going to push back and go, these are people that are non-Christians. They serve a different type of God than the American philosophy does. And people like them, and I'm using that in a very kind of stereotyping, general, derogatory way, they drove planes into our buildings and killed a bunch of our people. Shouldn't we go to the ends of the earth to get them and prosecute them in some form or fashion?
Well, that's exactly what I would agree with. But if you've got that type of evidence, why don't you put it forward and why don't you prosecute them? Why are you holding them for 15 years without charging them with anything? If they are those, if they're that evil, you would think you have a little bit of evidence, wouldn't you?
I agree with you. They're probably treated better than the people in many of our state's prisons.
Well, that's certainly the image that the government has conveyed. Now, I've heard a different. We have an attorney from my state who took a team down there, and I mean, they weren't being tortured as far as you could see from their physical appearance, but it's not a pretty place to be that they're in. So is it better than what an American would be treated if they were captured by the enemy in a combat situation? Probably so, but that's not the standard we should judge ourselves by.
Agreed. Yeah, someone told me recently that we should, if you're caught stealing, you should have your hand chopped off. We should move to a justice system like that.
Yeah, I was going to say, in many instances, Westerners have been beheaded.
Yes.
By some militants, but that doesn't mean that that's who we are.
Not even enemy combatants, just journalists. You know, highly publicized videos of heads being chopped off.
So
an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. If that's what they do, shouldn't we do it?
I don't think so. I don't think so. That's not our country. We don't forget due process, and we don't do things just because others do it.
If someone visits us from another country, you know, going through the right processes to get a visa if necessary and all that, and they do some sort of crime in the United States, are they afforded due process?
Yes, they have the right to be convicted by a jury and have evidence brought forward against them to confront their accusers, and they have the right to an appeal as if they were an American citizen. Absolutely.
Do they? So, but by what you just said, do they have all of the same privileges that a citizen has in going through our court system?
As far as I know, they do. There's no lesser standard because they're a foreign national.
I was listening to something talking about the Vietnam War and how the Viet Cong treated our prisoners, and we weren't going to sink to that level and do the things that they were doing, that we were still going to follow the Geneva Convention. And they were talking about specific articles of it, and I don't remember what those were, but we weren't going to do any sort of torture. And that's what this program was about, was specifically about torture, to compare it to what the United States has been doing. And this relates to the person that's been nominated for, is it the CIA or the NSA? I think it would be the CIA, and the black sites and taking terror suspects and waterboarding and other torture methods. Do you equate this to that?
Holding people in indefinite detention would definitely be a form of torture, even if they were treated relatively well. Because if you don't know what you're being accused of doing, and you don't have a tribunal to face, and you don't have anybody accusing you of anything, and you don't have the right to cross-examine them, and you merely just think how incensed an American president, an American population would be when an American is detained somewhere, and they say, well, what when American authorities find out about a person, and they say, well, why are you holding them? They say, well, Mr. President, we really don't have to tell you that. Well, when will they be afforded opportunity to appear in court? Well, we really don't tell you that. It's national security. We would be righteously indignant if we were told that we're not going to charge them with anything. We're not going to bring them before a tribunal. We're not going to give them the opportunity to have counsel. We're not going to give them the opportunity to cross-examine the accusers. We would be infuriated, as we should be. but we're not infuriated that this has been done for 15 years on people who have been scooped up off of a foreign soil and brought across the globe, and they've been locked up in a detention facility for all these years. That should make every American pause for thought.
We got pretty pissed off about the Wamberger guy, I think is that the name, from the one that like took a propaganda photo off of a hotel room in North Korea about a year ago, not even.
Yeah, something like that.
I don't remember. I remember people being a little pissed off about that, and that's just one person, and without any evidence, they can just go back and see kind of how he was treated, and he was like oxygen deprived for an extended period of time.
So, when we don't know for sure what happened, we can conclude that if he was healthy and then he was returned to us near death, that something bad happened.
And then he died a week or two later.
Yeah, died shortly after he was released.
Moving along to an article from CNN, Craigslist shuts down its personal section. On Friday, they shut down their section on the site that allows people seeking encounters with strangers. The move comes 2 days after the Senate approved a bipartisan legislation called Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act. Craigslist is making this change so that they are not held liable for the content that their users upload. I think you being a big newspaper guy, is a newspaper responsible for publishing a personal ad that might be content that goes against kind of like their editorial policy?
Well, my experience is that newspapers take some due diligence, and I like, if you're advertising, I did property management for years, and if you tried to run an ad that was coy enough that it was clear to them that they you were trying to exclude certain people, they would not run the ad. So if the newspaper is clear that the way you've got your ad worded that you're trying to attract something to be illegal, I would think that they would not want their, if they're read for publication, they would not want to run that.
But they're not held liable for the content of it necessarily. It's not their responsibility to police the content. They can police the content, but they're not obligated to. They're not held liable for the content that gets published.
Well, I don't know if I'm an expert enough to say that. They could be held to a lot. I mean, we do amazingly hold people businesses, and we extract responsibility and accountability where I'm not sure that that's wise, but but this bill passed, and it certainly has scared scared them to work Craigslist and not for us.
Well, Craigslist is a free website that, you know, it's like the internet. It's almost like eBay. People selling, buying, seeking. If you want, I've listed a couple apartments for rent for a friend, and within hours, I have people contacting me, and I've done it on Craigslist, and it's free. And they have things organized. You know, you can find stuff for your little local hometown, and then furniture, cars, whatever. And then there are personals. So people seeking other people does not mean sex trafficker.
No, not necessarily. It doesn't. But on the other hand, I'm told that people do use it for that purpose.
Okay.
The police run sting operations out of there for one thing, but that's not what this was geared toward. I think Craigslist is more concerned about people might be underage that are using the service or the adults that are hooking up with them, and they're just overly cautious now because of this legislation that's worked its way through the House and I think the Senate now.
Yes,
amending the Communications Decency Act.
And this is of interest to me from the point of view of being tech, but if the sex traffickers are out there and if they were using Craigslist, there has to be money in this industry that they are going to go find it somewhere else. They're going to get their marketing message somewhere else. Wouldn't it be wiser for the government to know where to go look for the sex traffickers to then monitor it and take them down versus then pushing them off to another place where they might not know?
That kind of sounds like the argument we make about residency restrictions on the registered citizen.
Right.
There's
something called Tor that would let you anonymize how you browse the internet and makes it very difficult for the government to trace you back. And then there are websites. There was a big thing 6-7 years ago about the Pirate Bay, Silk Road, where people were selling drugs or weapons, and it was an eBay kind of place for whatever, you know, and it was anonymous and people were using Bitcoin, which is an anonymous currency. So now everything is completely black and they shut it down, and immediately Silk Road 2 pops up. People still use cryptocurrencies to pay for stuff. Better to know where to go look for the things instead of then pushing everybody into the fringes and now you don't know where to go look.
I tend to agree with you. I think that politically, though, when you look at the title of this legislation, I mean, just Stop Enabling Child Sex Traffickers Act, how are you going to vote against that?
I agree.
How are you going to vote against that? What would happen in the next campaign cycle?
Yeah, they would be roasted.
They would say that, and Senator so-and-so voted against legislation to stop enabling sex traffickers.
Right.
So and then you can't soundbite your response out. What you just explained took more than what you can do in a soundbite.
Right.
And our political system operates in soundbites.
So Craigslist, in a statement, said, "Any tool or service can be misused. We can't take such risk without jeopardizing all of our other services, so we are regretfully taking Craigslist personals offline. Hopefully we can bring them back someday." So now, I don't know, however, you know, maybe you want to go meet up with the local, however you want to hook up, I don't care. But now you have to go find someplace else, and it was a free service, and maybe you like to go meet random people in bathrooms at truck stops. I don't know, but if that's your thing, that's your thing.
I've heard people do that. I remember a senator from Oregon. Don't let me offend our Oregon listeners. It was Senator Larry Craig from Idaho, who apparently liked to hook up in airport restrooms with other men. And he was a right wing family values type of guy until he was found to be trying to entice an undercover officer in the restroom of a Minneapolis St. Paul airport. And then rather than keeping a low profile, he said, "I want you to know something. I'm a United States senator." And they said, "Oh, is that right?" And what do you suppose happened next after he announced that he was a United States senator?
I don't know what.
He got a lot of publicity.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, of course that, yes.
But as a beat officer, as an officer on the beat or working a particular beat, you're not going to recognize, if you're in Minneapolis, you're not going to recognize Senator Larry Craig. I mean, who can name senators from outside their state?
Definitely.
So when he gave him his ID and said, "My name is Larry Craig," nobody would have thought given that a second thought, except for what he said, "And do you know who I am?" And the officer, I'm sure, said, "No, I really don't. Well, I'm a U.S. senator," and then, of course, that's a big catch for you.
Of course.
That's a big, I mean, you've ensnared something big, so of course that hit the press. If he had never said a word about being a U.S. senator, it would have gone through, those were citation offenses. I mean, it wasn't anything where he was arrested all the way. They gave him a citation. He's not supposed to be trying to pick up guys in the bathroom here at Minneapolis Airport. And he would have gone all about his life and paid the fine, but he had to announce that he was a United States senator, all the United States senators that are listening, if you ever get caught doing this again, you probably ought not to tell people who you are.
Right. And then for our last article, the title is, it's a letter to the editor at the Daily Journal Online, "Money is the Enemy of Truth." And this is an article about Missouri civil confinement or civil commitment, sex offender civil commitment, that costs 35 $1 million per year to house approximately 250 offenders. And there's an establishment in place that does not want to let them go. And there's no process for them to ever really get themselves treated out of the program.
Tragic, Andy, the civil commitment is declare all states have a form of civil commitment, but the civil commitment we're talking about is uniquely tailored for sexual offenders, and often it has a less robust due process, lower burden of proof required, and less robust review process for being released. And these people are being housed, warehoused for years and decades, and there's very little that can be done about it. The litigation has been tried at all levels and been unsuccessful. We had a U.S. District Judge in Minnesota who struck down their civil commitment. Of course, Minnesota appealed and they won. The Eighth Circuit reversed the trial judge. So the only way we'll change this is through legislative action. And the legislative action is difficult because the apparatus will defend and say that we're keeping society safe from these horrible people. And it's hard to vote. It's hard to vote against that when the testimony is, and as we remember, we discussed earlier in the program about the status quo, there's hundreds of people that are making their living off of these civilly committed individuals, and they're not ready to. When's the last time you've heard someone stand up and say, "What my job is totally useless, and I'd like to see it eliminated"? Right. And I'd like to. I mean, can you think of an instance where someone has reported that about their employment?
No, they generally don't do that.
So it's not likely that the civil commitment apparatus is going to be in favor of dismantling themselves.
Right. In the article, there was a doctor who works for the Department of Mental Health there, and he's a noted expert in sexual recidivism, testified age is the single potent dynamic risk factor, short of death, that we have right now in the prediction to reoffend. So few men in the 60s, even those with histories of multiple sexual offenses, reoffend as to make the recidivism rate of this group of men approaching zero statistically. But they're still there.
It's a tragedy. And there again, at the risk of irritating some of our listeners, we've become desensitized as a population to this lack of due process. The due process these people are getting is a sham. And they've served their time in prison. And this is something that follows them after prison. Magically, the government decides that they need mental health care. They disguise this because they couldn't do it as incarceration. So they can't say we want to just, the real goal is just to keep them confined.
Right.
But they pretend that they're going to provide them something that resembles a little bit of treatment, which they didn't bother to do for the years that they were incarcerated. And then they lock them up with very little opportunity to get out, because if you've been locked up in prison, you have no money. So you're in a system where you need an expert or two to help you, and it's a very complicated process to try to get out. You need a lawyer, and we don't like to give away free lawyers for civil. This is a civil process; it's not a criminal process, so you're not necessarily entitled to a lawyer under the Supreme Court determination of what entitles you to get counsel, because this is a civil proceeding. So you've got a horrible tragedy happening, and the average citizen either doesn't know or could care less if they do know, because it doesn't affect me, but it may affect you at some point in time. If we can confine people with very little due process, what's to stop them from confining you?
Well, I was listening to a program this morning talking about, the gun debate, where the guy that did the Florida shooting a month ago, that he was a fairly known person with some, we'll just say he's troubled. We can't make the medical claim that he is deficient, whatever. But he was a fairly well-known individual to law enforcement, but they can't really do anything because they don't have any way to go, quote unquote, take his guns without violating his civil rights. But here these guys are having their civil rights completely squashed without any due process. So we can't take that guy's gun that killed 17 people, but we can take away these people from potentially harming people. It seems like it's the same coin, just, you know, a different situation where one is acceptable, one is not.
Well, I don't want to suggest there's no due process. There is on paper due process. That's what saved the Minnesota program. There is on paper due process. But what's on paper and what's reality is not necessarily the same thing, because imagine if you've been incarcerated for a number of years, and at the end of that period of time, they say, we're going to file a petition to civilly commit you. Okay, well, when you look at your bank account, what was the balance after you'd been incarcerated for 7 years?
It was pretty low.
I would imagine that that's the case with the average offender. So then they say, you've got 30 days to file a response to this pleading. Well, how many lawyers did you have on retainer ready to that you could call on to file a response to their petition? Because they serve you the petition, and then you need to file a response. So you're up against, you're in an impossible situation. You're at a correctional facility. In most instances, they do occasionally file on people that are not in correctional facilities. But in most cases, you're in a correctional facility, and they're trying to extend your confinement. So the petition is filed, and you're helpless because within the statutory scheme, it doesn't say, and all individuals whose petition for commitment of assault shall be entitled to competent counsel at state expense if they can't afford it, and they shall be entitled to funds for expert witnesses. But those things were not written into the statutory scheme. And that the state shall bear the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt would be too high, but by the clear and convincing evidence that this person poses an elevated risk to do sexual harm or commit a violent sexual offense or something like that. They don't have a very high bar. They just say that they have to have a mental abnormality that renders them difficult to control their impulses. And some bogus language like that, that's very minuscule that they have to meet. If you do a regular civil commitment of a person, it's a very, very difficult standard because, like the guy in Florida, they needed to prove that he was an imminent threat to do harm to himself or others. But in this arena of sex offender commitment, the standard is much lower. It's much easier to commit a person. And then when we don't provide them with the mechanisms and the resources that they need, they end up in the facility. Well, then the facility doesn't want to let go of them because that's how they operate, is to keep the population means funding. So they're not charged with discharging as many people and releasing as they can. Their mission is slightly different or even unclear to them. So if it was required by statute that after a person's been in this facility for 180 days, if the state can't show X, Y, and Z, they shall be released. But that's not in the statute that way. It's that the person has the burden is put on them to show that they should be really. It's all crazy. It's a blemish on American honor. And I'm willing to say that it's a blemish on American honor that we would do this to people, and we should be ashamed of ourselves.
You said something to me on the phone recently where there are, in relating to capital punishment, that there are many states that won't extradite people if they are being sought with the death penalty.
Countries, not states.
Sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yes. Countries that will not extradite people that have the death penalty being held over them. And that's sort of similar.
That happens when a country that doesn't allow capital punishment, when an American is being sought for extradition, they will decline the extradition because the prosecutor is forced to take capital punishment off the table. And prosecutors hate it, but if they want to put the person in life for prison so at least they can feel that they've accomplished some amount of vengeance, then they will take the death penalty off the table so that the country will extradite them.
I just use that as an analogy of when you're saying the blemish on our American values and so forth, and that's something a little bit more concrete to put our fingers on.
Well, it should be the fact that we would lock someone up after they do their time and not provide them with anything in the way of meaningful defense and resources so that they can get out and secure their freedom that never should have been taken away from them. That should be shocking and appalling to the average American. It isn't, but it should be.
There was the lady that debated Emily Horowitz, and she said that after the age of 18, you can treat minors for whatever their sexual deviance might be. But as soon as they turn 18, there is no treatment. That's what her belief is.
Well, I don't know how to respond to a person like that.
To say that literally on the day that of 18 years from the date of your birth, that all of a sudden you are now no longer treatable, but yesterday you were treated, it's ludicrous for someone to think that way. People would mature at various rates. Some people may not be able to age out of a program like this. Some people might be able to be treated out. Some people might not be. There would have to be a way for someone to, you're never going to get it down to the 0% chance of someone reoffending, but I don't know. This just seems ridiculous. And like, going back to the title of the article, that money is the enemy of truth. So they're spending $35 million a year to hold these 250 people for what?
Well, it's a form of preventative detention, and that's not American values. We don't lock people up for what they may do.
Right. Everybody will be locked up.
We lock people up for what they have done. Yes. And when they pay their debt, we turn them loose.
Yeah. We had a comment on the website that I wanted to read, and it was about episode 16 where we had Brenda Jones guesting. And she said, I guess, I'm assuming Saddles, I don't know the gender, so Andy, Larry, and Brenda was listening to the podcast last night. Well, it was very nice to hear Brenda and Larry describe some of the issues, and even how Brenda got involved in all this. Also, the ordeals of looking up laws and trying to come up with the logic and reasoning to all this sex offender hoopla. I just want to say we need a lot more people involved in this issue as it is becoming a movement, not just a sex offender issue, but a civil rights matter. Saddles, I think you made a very good point and very much greatly appreciate having comments sent in. Love hearing feedback on the episodes.
And if you want to reach us, you can do so by a number of ways, registrymatters.co, or you can email an old-fashioned email at registrymatterscast@gmail.com, or you can phone call or text 747-227-4477, and we love those phone calls because we can play them on the podcast.
Yes, we can. And Larry, because of the technical challenge, I think we should cut it, and we can go over topics in the future.
Sure thing, Andy.
And but the outgoing Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, had this to say in his closing remarks, and it just, I don't know. I thought it was a great thing for to be said. And he says, "This can be a very mean-spirited town, drawing knowing laughs and a round of applause. But you don't have to choose to participate in that. Each of us gets to choose the person we want to be and the way we want to be treated and the way we will treat others." And that's Rex Tillerson, the outgoing Secretary of State. I thought he did a good job with that one.
He did indeed. And I thought of the cabinet selection. So he was one of the final selections of the president. So it's unfortunate that he's a great chief executive, and he sacrificed that career to serve his country as the Secretary of State for a period of a little over a year, and now he's out. So
By tweet, he was fired on Twitter.
Like, I think in my lifetime, I don't remember that ever happening before. But
Larry, as always, I greatly appreciate it, and I'm sorry about the technical challenges, and we'll see what we can do about it going forward.
Thanks, Andy.
Have a great night. Talk to you soon.
All right.